everyone. Welcome to the Racing Writers Podcast. I'm your host, Kelly Crandall. I've got another good one for you today. Blake Harris is here. He is the car chief of that number 19 car of Martin Truex Jr. at Joe Gibbs Racing. And Blake was an excellent conversationalist as we learn what a car chief is, what his responsibilities are, and how he got here. Of course, you know I love doing that on the podcast, and Blake has a really cool history of how he got into NASCAR, coming from Texas, racing himself, watching his dad race, and we learn about how Blake learned to appreciate equipment and the enjoyment of taking race cars apart and putting them back together, and all about that and how it led to his career as a car chief. Blake is the guy that you hear about when somebody gets ejected on that 19 team, but he's also the guy you probably saw on TV a few years ago with that really big power saw on pit road at Talladega. So Blake is that guy. And again, he was an excellent conversationalist to talk about his history, how he got into NASCAR, going to trade school. As I mentioned, he's a former racer, so we went down that route. How he got to Furniture Row Racing out in Colorado, back when the team, as he will tell you, was racing for 30th, and that was a good day before Martin Truex Jr., Cole Pearn, and they built that team up into championship contenders. Now that team, some of them, of course, migrated over to Joe Gibbs Racing, so this is the third year for Blake at JGR. We talk about the playoffs. Being ejected, I was really surprised to hear just how plugged in Blake can be with the team. I was not surprised to hear that, I guess I should say. I was surprised at how plugged in he is when he is not at the racetrack. A lot of ground we covered. I was really appreciative of Blake for wanting to do this and bring a new perspective to the podcast. I've talked to drivers, I've talked to crew chiefs, I've talked to media members. So now we have a car chief. So really excited to go down this different road. Something of note that's really cool that I was able to make this happen, one of the reasons I was able to make this happen, is because I went to Caitlin Vincey. Caitlin is Blake's other half and fellow media member. So I went to Caitlin and I said, hey, do you think Blake would want to be on the podcast? And do you think he would be someone fun to talk to? And of course, she planted the seed and here we are. So I appreciate her and Tyler Overstreet and everybody at Joe Gibbs Racing for making it happen. So let's get to it. Again, it was a really great conversation and a fun new role to learn about NASCAR. Here is Blake Harris on the Racing Writers Podcast. I love the fact, I think this is probably the latest that I've recorded one, which I'm fine to do. It works for me. I have nothing going on, but it made me think it's probably just because you guys work some long days, don't you? What's a normal work day for you, Blake?
Yeah, I mean, like I was up at 5 today, headed in, and I got home literally 20 minutes ago. So I wasn't having a lot of confidence even in the 7 o'clock being that was your latest. But I mean, we always kind of work long hours. It's not, I mean, kind of depends on scenarios too. I mean, you know, this is playoffs. My team, like we have a lot of, you know, specific races circled, you know, Talladega, we're going to just try to not wreck. But Vegas, we have, Martin's really good there. He's won a couple times. So I feel like we kind of put absolutely as much as we can into those races. So yeah, we a little bit of time into it for sure.
Well, I appreciate you wanting to do this and doing this after you get home, because I'm sure you want to spend some time with the family. So I appreciate that. Let's get into, just explain for listeners who maybe don't know or don't know much about the role of a car chief. And let me just say right off the bat, if I say crew chief at any point tonight, just ignore me, because my brain just thinks drivers, crew chiefs. So it's no disrespect, just ignore it. But let's go into just what the role is, maybe an overview again for people who don't know what you do as a car chief.
Yeah, I think that title maybe varies company-wise and team to team. For me personally, I work with our crew chief and engineers, mainly the crew chief, really closely. And those guys kind of, they're always working on sim and figuring out, you know, what setups and stuff that we're going to run and how they want the car presented. And my job, like I work with the mechanics really closely, and we have a lead mechanic in the shop that always stays home, plus my traveling guys. So you know, those traveling guys kind of, I make sure whatever work needs to be done in the shop gets done. Now, when we used to only be in the shop like 2 to 3 days a week. Since the COVID schedules happen, that's kind of flipped. So we're in the shop 4 or 5 days a week and only at the track one. So it's a little bit different, right? So it's now, I'm a little more involved in the weekly prep. We still kind of get the cars presented in similar conditions, but so basically anything, like when we get to the track, when the car's presented to NASCAR, dealing with the tech officials, the tech procedures, anything like that, making sure that our car is compliant to all the rules. That's my main responsibility. we have, you know, setup plate guy that gets the car, you know, kind of all the core stuff in. But when it comes to the final setup to go on the track, it's my job to make sure that all those numbers that the crew chief and engineer came up with are in the car correctly. So each mechanic that works with me or for me, they kind of have their own things that they do, you know, so I don't necessarily touch every bolt on the car. You know, it's kind of everybody has their own responsibility, but, you know, ultimately the car and the prep and all of that's my main responsibility.
Going to touch on a few things you mentioned there about officials and being at the track versus being at the shop, but I want to kind of go in order here a little bit. You were amongst the group that came over to Joe Gibbs Racing when Furniture Row dissolved. So you came over at that point with Cole and Martin, obviously. Yeah. So this would be what, 3 years I think it is now with Joe Gibbs Racing?
Yep. We're almost done with the third season since I've
been there. All right. So third season, I think before that it was 9 years with Furniture Row, right? You would put in some time with them and a lot of memories. Take me back to just getting your foot in the door in NASCAR, because I know there's some stuff previously that I want to touch on about just getting into racing and things of that nature. But just getting to NASCAR, let's start there first, and getting to Furniture Row. How did that happen?
Yeah, so I'll take you through it as quickly as I can. So I graduated high school out of Texas, moved straight to North Carolina. And at that time, there were kind of like two trade schools. There's NASCAR Tech One, and at the time, there's Bobby Isaac Motorsports out of Hickory. And I'd known some people from racing that had kids that had moved here and were racing quarter midgets. My whole family raced growing up, so we've known that family for years. So that guy worked at a Briggs & Stratton warehouse and basically got me a part-time job. So I moved here. I had a part-time job. I could go to school. And I basically did this trade school for probably 6 months. Most of the stuff that we did was stuff that I kind of learned already growing up. Like when, you know, I was fortunate. I went through with a lot of really good racers. I mean, there were some guys that just showed up and went, I want to learn what NASCAR is about. And it was probably, you know, a lot more for them. But, you know, we had a pit stop class where, you know, we learned to change tires and all that stuff. So there's quite a few things that I did learn. But anyways, there was a couple guys that were really close in the industry. So when they'd have some of these entry-level positions available, these guys kind of had contacts, because I mean, I did the same thing probably everybody else my age did in 2005. I mean, you drive up to places and put your resume on the top of the tallest stack and probably watch it get thrown in the trash before you walk out the door. So I mean, you couldn't get a job in racing when I got here unless you knew somebody. So I like to think that I did well in the class, and that's kind of what got me some contacts from that school. And I actually got a job interview at Gibbs in Everham. I'd been here like 6-7 months. I couldn't talk to anybody, right? And I mean, not a bottom level team, anything. And I got in the same week, I get an interview with Everham and Gibbs, like within like a couple of days. And the Gibbs one was an intern position and the Everham one was a paying position. And I got in the door as tearing down motors in the engine shop. So I grew up working in my dad's automotive shop, his machine shop. So, you know, I could tear stuff down pretty easily. I mean, I'd been doing it for years. So I got in the door there right before I turned 19, I think. And that was it. So I was in the engine shop for 4 years. I'd started to do a lot of short track stuff on the side. I'm really interested, you know, in all the setup and the car side more than anything in the engine shop. I mean, in like 8 or 9 months, I moved up to sub-assembly. And in a few months, you know, I was doing other jobs and I kind of looked around. I'm like, there are like 6 engine builders in this place. And I don't think any of them are going to die or quit soon. So I was like, and I'm pretty much like 60th in line to be an engine builder. I'm like, you know, the chassis shop, like there's all kinds of jobs there that interest me, you know? So I was fortunate, you know, that company was awesome. I mean, the management there, I mean, cause I was 20, maybe, I don't even think I'd turned 21 yet. And I'm like, man, how do I go tell these guys that I have a job that I really like, but I want to do something different. So anyways, a little long-winded on how I'm getting to Furniture Row, but so I got transferred to the chassis shop, the R&D department, which was pretty critical in the steps to the Furniture Row path. The guy that I worked for in the R&D department, not directly, but oversaw everything, was Pete Rondeau. And he was one of the guys that kind of got me to go out and interview at Furniture Row eventually once Everham shut down. So I did a couple years, what was supposed to be all R&D and kind of learning all the car side. I think I did a handful of months, and then Everham took on a fourth team. That's when AJ came and ran the 44. I think Reed Sorensen was running the 43. So the R&D team kind of managed like all their people kind of became that fourth team. So I got really close with the car chief on that team at the time, and he like kind of started showing me all the ways to set up those cars. And really I got to go testing during the week, and then I got to do race prep. So I kind of was drinking from a fire hose the first couple of years there, but I mean, it was great. I mean, I got to learn a lot in a really short amount of time in a really unique scenario that I kind of almost lucked into just the right timing, you know, because I could have done any job in there and been plugged into, you know, installing crush panels or something. And that might've been the only thing that I did. So I was fortunate to kind of get in that scenario. So Everham went to RPM, Rich Petty Motorsports. And then when they went to the Ford shift, I had an opportunity to kind of stay on as like a tire specialist. It was the only spot that they had open. I had started my own little short track team. We were running like Allison Legacy cars, Legend cars. We were racing, I mean, the last year that I worked at Everham, I think we raced 80 times. And it was pretty much from Virginia to Georgia, Tennessee, like just kind of multiple times per week. I had a few guys that worked for me, and it was just, you know, work Everham during the day, and on the weekends at nights, we were short track racing. So I kind of, at the moment, I was like, man, if I go do this full-time tire guy deal, that really doesn't interest me, because I had done that some to fill in. I was like, man, I don't know. This just isn't for me. I was like, I don't know. I'll go figure it out. Well, I had, at the time I had driving for me on the lower level stuff was Timmy Hill. His dad had been considering at that time starting a truck team. Like literally we had gone and looked at a couple teams to buy out. And when all this stuff kind of came to an end at Everham, so I was like, well, we'll do some more short track racing. If this truck deal starts up, then, you know, maybe I'll start running that for them. And that's kind of where I was at. And maybe a week after Everham, my last day at Everham, we were just working on our short track stuff. And Pete Rondeau called me. He's like, hey, we got the setup job out in Colorado from Truro. I've been here for a little while. Setup job available if you want it. I really need a good guy. And I was like, man, Colorado, I really didn't have any interest. I mean, I'd been to Colorado a couple of times, loved Colorado, but I was just like, I moved to North Carolina to go racing, you know? So then Mark McArdle was going out there. He had run, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but I mean, he's done all kinds of stuff. I knew him from the engine shop, and then he oversaw the engine shop, the chassis shop, everything at Everham. And he had just gone out to Furniture Row as well. So he was the second guy to call me. He's like, hey, I think Pete talked to you and we need a good setup guy out here. And I'm like, so it was more like out of respect. I was like, I'm going to go interview and go see what they got. I had no interest in really taking it. So I go out there, and so for some reason, after visiting once, I'm like, man, you know, I was like, I didn't move to North Carolina to short track race. Like if I want a short track race, I go back to Texas, you know? So I was like, I moved here to do this, like this cup racing thing. So I'm going to go give it a shot. I'm like, maybe when I'm done. Was not running well. I mean, this was not like a top tier. I mean, everybody that knows Furniture Row now that didn't know them in 2009, 2010. I mean, when I first went there, I mean, if we finished 30th, that was a good day. Like we turned that car around to go the next week because we're like, man, we've got something here. You know, it's tough. So, you know, I ended up going out there. I was a setup plate guy for a couple of years, and then did a little short track racing around there in all my spare time while I was shop based. So I think 10, 11, 12. So 3 years I was shop based, and then their car chief ended up getting hurt and I filled in for him a few weeks and then just kind of took over from there. So that was a long winded version to get you your question answered.
It's okay. It is okay. That's what a podcast is for. You answer the question. Yeah. Answer the question and we're all good. And if the story comes from it, even better. What I love about that is you mentioned about trade school, but it sounds like a lot of really kind of getting into what you're doing now was you were just learning as you went. And also you did mention your dad raced when you were growing up, you raced a little bit too. So a lot of it was just hands-on experience. It wasn't necessarily from a classroom.
Yeah. I mean, that was, I got a quick little, the trade school story. One of my favorite stories, one of the guys I met when I was 18 there is to this day, one of my best friends. He still does a bunch of short track racing stuff. And we always talk once a week about just different stuff I've got going on, he's got going on. But anyways, he's from Ohio. There was a couple other of his buddies that he raced with growing up from Ohio. So there was like four or five of us in this like assembly and setup class. And it was day one, the teacher came in, they had this complete car. They're like, all right, well, we're going to tear all the suspension off this thing. And then, you know, eventually we're going to put it all back together and we'll go through setup and all this. He's like, I got to run we got, you know, this new student, I got to turn some paperwork in, whatever. I'll be back in, you know, 20 minutes or whatever. I got to go over to the main school. So he comes back and we have like the whole, like everything suspension wise, stripped, assembled, laying on the floor. And he's like, what are we doing? And I was like, well, you said we were taking all this. That's what we need to do, right? He's like, well, yeah, but that was today's class. And my, you know, it was like a 3-hour class. And anyways, after like the second day, that was, it was 2 days of that week. He was like, I think y'all should go ask for your money back for this class. And, but again, I was fortunate. I got into that class with a lot of racers that had, I mean, that's what we did growing up was take, right. You know, we worked on all our own race cars and my dad's race cars or whatever. So I feel like I was somehow ended up in a lot of unique scenarios that kind of allowed me to excel on the path. And a lot of it was learned along the way, but I mean, I started racing when I was 11 and when I was 3-4 years old was at dirt tracks with my dad. So, I mean, you kind of learn a lot along the ways, but the fundamentals for sure. I mean, there's, you know, learn stuff every day about, you know, all the new stuff that we do and things that we learn, but the fundamentals there definitely started early.
Right. And so on that topic, you mentioned you raced, your dad raced when you were growing up, you did go-karts. I know you did some asphalt stuff, so late model stuff, but for you, it was a balance between you enjoyed driving for a while, but also learning to put the cars together and take them apart.
Yeah. I mean, the way I grew up, you didn't have a choice. I mean, my dad, I ran go-karts for a couple of years. I worked on every one of them and we raced dirt. My dad ran dirt sprint cars for like 20 years, and that's what I grew up around. And when I started racing, I mean, we got home. I mean, you cleaned the trailer out from top to bottom. You cleaned everything off before you even touched anything. And we didn't go race unless you did all the work. And I remember I did a couple years of go-karts, and my dad comes home one day with this trailer with this like 86 Buick Regal on the back of it, straight from the junkyard. I'm like, what's that? He's like, that's your new race car. And I mean, I was 13. We stripped it down to bare chassis, built it all. The only thing we had done was we had somebody else put a cage in it. And we built this car from the ground up and we get it all done. I'm so excited. The season's coming up. He's like, all right, we got to strip this thing back down so we can paint it. I'm like, what? You're kidding me. I just turned 14. I'm like, man, we took all winter building this car. You know, he let me break bolts off and then I have to drill them out and figure out. And he's like, well, now you understand what over tightening the bolts like. I'm like, okay. So yeah, I kind of learned all that stuff growing up. And but I mean, it that's just kind of how I was raised. I mean, we didn't race unless I worked on it. But my point was, I was 14 by the time I went to the track. You learned respect for the equipment that I drove, because if I tore it up, I had to fix it. And you know, I mean, I think at times you get younger kids in some of the series that maybe don't have that same feel, and you know, maybe they're a little bit drive a little more over their head, but I knew whatever I tore up, I was going to have to go home and fix. And if I couldn't fix it in a week, we weren't racing. So, and by the time we get to the track, I mean, I'd already taken the car apart and put it back together 2 or 3 times. So, I mean, there wasn't anything minus, you know, I mean, my dad would handle some of the motor stuff. I mean, if we were changing springs or shocks or whatever in between sessions, I mean, that was me. He'd jack the car up and I'd get after it. So, but yeah, that was a lot of fun. I learned a lot, you know, at a young age being able to do that, but that was all my dad pushed me. For sure.
Yeah. I think you said you started racing around 11, right? Did I hear that correctly?
Yep. Go-karts at 11. Yeah.
All right. So you started 11. How long does your driving career go for, and just when and why does that end at some point?
I think I'm trying to think when I mentally gave up, like I'm not going to drive. Right. Cause I mean, I think every race car driver, I mean, you run well and you're constantly just like, oh, I can do that. I can go do whatever it is you want to do. So I ran the cars for a couple of years. I went over to dirt stock cars. I drove, I think my dad's modified, the dirt modified once. And then we moved into, he had kind of started transitioning into asphalt, which was new for my family. I ran asphalt trucks for a couple of years. I ran a late model for a guy for a couple of years. And then I moved to Texas. Like I graduated high school. I had a late model ride in Texas. We were running touring series and stuff, you know, wasn't costing me or my family anything. And it just kind of like, I knew I'd had some college scholarships that I could have taken in Texas. And I was kind of trying to decide what school I wanted to go to. And my dad was like, you know, where do you want to be in 5 years? So I want to be in North Carolina working on race cars. And he's like, well, don't you think you should be out there? And I fully intended when I moved to North Carolina to continue my schooling. Like I went to that trade school. I was going to, you know, enroll in a college out here and start getting my degree. And I just ended up kind of in the workforce and full hammer down on learning all of that hands-on. And so it was kind of when I moved, I just was like, well, I don't have a race car. You know, I didn't have money to race at all. I didn't have anything when I moved out here. So you know, I always had the opportunity to maybe go back and drive for guys, but I just, you know, I started working. So at that time, that was kind of like, I knew that I didn't have the backing to go fund something myself and go race. And I knew that the best way for me to make a living and still be involved was going to be to work on them. And I was always intrigued with the setup side and everything that goes along with the preparation. I mean, I've always enjoyed pretty much every aspect of racing from top to bottom. And so when I was in North Carolina, I started running my own little race team. And sometimes I would go shake the guys' cars down for them. And then when I moved to Colorado, I was there for about a year or two. And my dad's like, man, why don't you take this? I got this. My sister was running super late models at the time in Texas. And he had had this backup car. She hadn't been running. She graduated high school and she hadn't been running for a year or two. He's like, I got this backup car. You should just take it up there and run it in Colorado. And I'm like, and I'm not bringing it up here. I'm like, I don't really have money to race. You know, these guys, like I'd been crew chiefing for guys, helping guys build cars. And I'm like, you know, there's $150,000 late models out here. I'm like, I don't know what you think that thing's going to do. Well, finally I drug it up there and I raced, like I just picked their big shows and went and ran a few times and ran really well and had a lot of fun with that. So my point was, I still hadn't given up on my driving. And to this day, that car is still in Texas and I will go get it at some point in the next couple of years, and I'm going to go test around here. And so Furniture Row days, Todd Barrier came as crew chief when I was racing late models. I was still shop based at the time and he knew that. Well, when the cup cars went to the high camber rear ends, we had all our own axles and drive plates and stuff made out in Colorado, machine designed by a local guy, but we had to do durability testing because we had never raced this before. So because I had been racing, Todd was like, hey, well, Blake will go test the car for us. I'm like, well, what do you mean? So I went and did 2 500-mile tests at Pikes Peak driving. I'll never forget, I'm the setup plate guy. I'm like, Todd, how do I set this thing up for me driving? I'm like, I have no idea. Like, I'm not a cup driver. He's like, where did we race last? I'm like, Phoenix. He goes, well, that's a mile track. I'm like, yeah. And Kurt had just, like, we had a setup for Kurt, like testing there or something. Or I think maybe I can't remember if Regan or Kurt ran that last race. Anyways, he's like, well, set it up like that. And that's how I unloaded and went and ran these laps. So, you know, I've never been, and I'll never be done driving. I always run something. But as far as like a career, I think you get to the point where you're like, well, you know, the funding's not there to go to Cup. So if I'm going to be involved at the highest level of motorsports, then I think I can make it on working on them. So that's kind of where I'm at now.
Oh my goodness. I love this. I'm enjoying this so much already. Before I bring it back to your current role, one last thing on getting to this point. Your other half might have let it be known that, and you were just talking about moving to North Carolina and schooling and scholarships. She might have let it be known that you had some music scholarship offers, that you're musically inclined. So I wanted to know a little bit about that, but you chose racing.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed music stuff, you know, mainly through high school and stuff. I mean, I played, kind of taught myself. My mom taught me a little bit of piano when I was younger. And then as I got older, got into band and stuff in middle school, learned to read music and kind of taught myself to learn more, learned a little bit of guitar. My main thing through high school was saxophone. So I can't remember exactly how much, but about, you know, half of a scholarship, you know, to go somewhere, and then academics, it would have covered the rest. So I definitely had opportunity to continue with some music stuff. But if I had the time now, I would probably still do some of that. I just have two kids. So I don't think anybody has any time when they have two kids or a job like we both have now. So maybe one day. So she's super musically talented as well. So I'm curious to see which one of our kids is going to get the mix of us two.
And that's true. So. Yeah, that's true. That'll be fun to kind of see how that develops. All right. So bringing it back to the car chief role, I imagine being at the track as much as you are, and one of the responsibilities you're talking about is making sure everything's up and up with the car, getting it through inspection. So you must have a pretty good relationship with those same NASCAR officials every week, taking that car through inspection. What is that like, though, being a team member going through inspection? Is it lighthearted? Are you guys like eyeing the officials? Tell me, like, what is it like going through inspection for people who don't pay attention to the crew guys? Are you just standing around? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it's like any relationship with anybody, right? You have a little bit different relationships with different guys, and it's kind of their personalities. And you try to, I mean, I have a few guys that work under me, and over the years, I've had several guys that work underneath me, and you try to understand how they react. You know, if an official sees something they don't like, you want to be respectful. If you disagree with them, then you got to figure out how to tell them your point of view. And ultimately, they're going to be right. But there's times, you know, we live in the gray area. So you know, they'll be like, well, this isn't how this is supposed to be. And if you have your opinion on it, I try to do as good a job as I can to be respectful of what they think and how we can come to meet in the middle potentially. I'm always looking for the middle, not just their way. So, but yeah, it's stressful with what we have these days. You know, the tolerances are so much different than when I first started in this job, and with all the Hawkeye system, and we never show up anticipating a fail, right? Like, I mean, if there's a window this big, like we want to be right to the edge, and it doesn't always work out that way. You know, we have a Hawkeye at our shop and it doesn't always work out to be the exact same as what theirs reads. And, you know, that's where you can get yourself in a little bit of trouble. So they know that we're trying to get everything we can. And a lot of those guys have seen me since day one as a car chief, and they know it's just stressful on kind of depending on what time of the year it is. You know, when we unload the first couple of races of the year, is not the same stress level as it is trying to get through the playoffs. And that's just their deterrent system that they've laid out. We take advantage of everything that we can, right? So if they let us go through tech 17 times with no penalties, we would do it because we'd be trying to manipulate a way to find another edge. So, you know, they have that stuff in place, but at the same time, it's like you go and you can't in the playoffs, you don't want to do something that's going to kill your track position at the start. You don't want to do something that's going to make you do a pass in the middle of, you know, at the beginning of the race and put you behind. Fortunately, we've been strong enough to have some mistakes in the early rounds that you can overcome, and you're really good cars. You know, Larson started in the back but last week or a couple of weeks ago. And I mean, you can get to the front when you're good, but like you can't expect it to go perfect every time that happens. So it's stressful from the point that you just want to get through and not make one of Pockers' tweets, right? You know, like if he doesn't talk about you, that's a good tech day. But no, the officials, when it comes, my favorite part at the end of the season, whatever the last race is, like when you go through the first time, hopefully pass, like you're shaking everybody's hands, and, you know, some of them you hug, and like you've been through so much with those guys. And even though you're on opposite sides at times, you know, you're trying to get stuff through and they're trying to officiate it. You all travel together. We've been some of those guys that have been around since I've started traveling that you get to know. I mean, you know, before they had families, you know, their families, you know, where they live, you know, what part of the country they're from, because those guys are kind of from all over. And, you know, when certain things, you know, happen in life, I mean, there's good and bad things that people go through. You feel like you somewhat experience those with them, even though you don't work with them every day. And we go to the tech center, you see those guys, and they're the same people tearing your cars apart. And, you know, so, I mean, I think those relationships are super important. And I do my best to be respectful. Maybe in times things get heated, it doesn't always come across that way, but that's really what I'm after. Cause I mean, I think that goes a long way with those guys.
Yeah. So on a bad day, when you get ejected, I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask for the fans who don't know, and I want to hear it from a car chief's perspective. Why does the car chief, why are you guys the ones that get thrown out? Because I think a lot of fans would say, well, why not the crew chief? They're the one that are overseeing the team. You know, that would be a bigger penalty. So from your perspective, Blake, just explain for everybody, why are you guys the ones taking the fall?
So when we used to practice all the time, there was two scenarios. You either have the car chief ejected or an engineer. And it's always at the race director's discretion, right? Like he can pick whoever he wants. Because when that first came out, it's like, cool, I'll just be the front end mechanic. Like they know that. They're like, hey, you're out of here. So they're just about as smart to cover everything that we come up with pretty quickly. So I think the thought process behind that was when you rolled up in your initial failure. Now, again, the way we race now, I don't want to say you can't get ejected. You'll see crew chiefs get ejected if it's like a big ticket item that NASCAR really doesn't like, but you don't see car chiefs or engineers get ejected now since we've gone to the what I call COVID style racing with no practice, no qualifying. So when we show up now, it's because our first run, like if we fail once, our first run is the first time we've seen their Hawkeye. You know, they're kind of giving you basically a free run at it to make sure, you know, if there's something that's maybe a little bit of a gray area that you don't agree on, go get it fixed, come back. But that second time through, if you mess up, you're going to the back. So, I mean, really, if everything read perfect, you got everything exact the way that you needed to, you understand 100%, you know, if they don't like something, like you've got to clarify that. Like, what is it specifically that you don't like? Because you can't have that conversation again the next time or you go to the back. So there's been a lot of ejections this year. I wanted to credit myself that I hadn't been ejected this year, but now that we're breaking down the process this year, it's maybe because there's less of a chance. being able to be ejected. But the car chiefs would typically get ejected if something on your car, like body wise, any other component really. And that kind of goes back to answering your question earlier, like my main responsibility is the car. And it's my responsibility, even if it's something one of my guys does by mistake or whatever, like I oversee all that, or I oversee the guys that are doing that. So it's ultimately my responsibility. You would get the race engineers ejected if we rolled up and we failed like a mechanical measurement, because I think in their mind, it was like, well, the race engineer is telling him to put that slug in the car. And that is the case. I mean, there's a lot of times I'm getting ejected, I'm like, that really wasn't on me, but all right, I guess I'm leaving. So I'm sure there's plenty of other times it was on me and I wasn't the guy that got thrown out. So
where do you go when you get ejected, and can you still be of any assistance when that happens, when you have to leave?
Yeah. So I don't want to say there's a good ejection, but the best ejections that I had, when I had enough time, I would catch a flight with the Xfinity team, because typically it'd be like pre-qualifying impound. So I would catch a flight back with JGR's Xfinity team, and I could go back to kind of like our war room at JGR. And I mean, I'm mic'd up the same, like with James, I think I still, like I call all the adjustments to the pit crew. So we try to, like, all of our systems are based on doing everything the same, right? Like you don't want to change a guy that's saying something or doing something, because you kind of just have your flow in the race and you want as little distraction as possible. So I can hear the radio and I can talk to those guys remotely, but I just can't, same as the crew chiefs, right? You can't be on any of the main radios talking to the guys. I can relay everything, you know, so I can hear something and, you know, message James or, you know, and I'm with the engineers now that don't travel, and talking to those guys, as much communication as that I'm allowed to have. So, but I mean, it's really, being on the remote end of it's not that bad, you know, it's quiet and, you know, it's not all this noise and I'm not like getting burned fixing stuff or anything. So, I mean, it's not terrible, but you know, the goal is to stay at the racetrack the entire weekend. And I struggle with that for a little while. So,
right. That's okay. Listen, I mean, that just means you're doing your jobs. You're trying to, you're trying to find that edge. So speaking on that, one last thing on this topic of just, do you think it would be something to where we should try to find a way maybe to kind of better understand when somebody gets ejected or when somebody quote unquote fails inspection? Because I think there's a misconception between, you mentioned there, the tolerances are so small versus what is just flat out cheating that somebody's trying to get through inspection. So, I mean, do you ever think about if there'd be something the sport could do to help understand even us, the media and the fans, of, okay, they failed because it was just a tolerance versus no, they flat out broke the rules.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's fairly simple. The way I look at it is, if you have a guy that fails twice and goes to the back, and even sometimes a guy that fails and has to do a pass-through, so that means he failed three times. The pass-through, man, that's a tough one. Like, but it's easy to do. That typically comes from a misunderstanding, right? So like you go through, the machine reads something, you think this is where you're at, and you make a change, and it say that something is 30 thousandths outside of the tolerance, and you're like, all right, well, I'm going to go 40 to make sure I'm good. And you go up there and it says you moved it 10. It could be how it picking something up. Like maybe somebody bumped a plate and it wasn't on there right the first time. So you got a bad read. So you had bad information, you know? So, I mean, there's all those things that happen, and there's nothing more frustrating. You know, I don't do it anymore, but I used to, you know, get ejected or thrown out. And the worst thing you could do is like read all the comments that everybody's saying, because it's like, man, these guys, oh, there's Toyota cheating again, or there's Truex's team like really giving it to the driver because he's got to start in the back. And it's just, you hear all that stuff. And for me, the line is, we talked about like now if a crew chief gets ejected, right? Now, if somebody gets ejected, you know that that's probably something pretty blatant. It's something they really didn't like. And it's something that you knew was really flirting with the line, right? And we're not talking balls and strikes. We're talking something that was like, man, that's really pushing it on something you probably should have left alone. But all that starting in the back and the regular pass through or the other, what I call smaller failures, can easily just be something didn't shake out to be what you thought it was going to be. I mean, we have stuff happens every week. Our car was a little bit, we failed the first time through last week. And I was like, wow, that just, it read differently than what we anticipated. And we have a lot of really good tools to know where we're at. And in JGR, you know, we know where we're at every week, but you go out on the road somewhere and it's different equipment and different places. And, you know, I mean, it's just, sometimes it shifts a little bit. And in NASCAR's defense, they give you, you know, our body tolerance is 150 thousandths one way to 150 the other. So of course we want to build everything at 149, you know, and to think that's going to pass every week is probably not realistic, but that's the world that we live in, because if we build our cars to zero or even 100, like, we're going to get our butt kicked every week. So it's just how the sport works.
Yeah. Now, from what I could tell, you don't have a big social media presence, unless I just overlooked it. So how are you reading the comments when you get ejected to see what everybody's saying?
I'll get on Twitter a little bit. I mean, I have about every account that I can. I just don't post a whole lot. I mean, I have a little suspension business that I do on the side. That's probably what I post the most for, just to, you know, try to give like some of our customers recognition when they run well, and, you know, do some promotion stuff to kind of help keep that going. But that's about it. Yeah. I mean, I tolerate it, and, but you know, it's what, if you get ejected or if something goes bad, you're like, all right, well, how's this going to be presented? You know, yeah. And it's, you know, I always look at Pockris's stuff because he's pretty up to date on, you know, just to see like if somebody in front of us is going to go to the back or whatever. And then there's the comments. You're like, oh, great. This is what people really think. But
yeah, we all do it.
I'm sure I don't understand what happens on the specifics of their day-to-day jobs. And, you know, for them to, you know, I understand from the outside looking in how it maybe looks not great sometimes. And then, you know, there's guys that do it all the time. And we've had runs where we fail a lot and have to start in the back. And it's just like, they don't maybe understand that it's just a result of you, you know, going to a track that, you know, Martin's really good at, and you've got to push every little piece that you can to try to get that through, because, you know, if you do, you're going to go have a good day. So,
yeah. So I guess you saying there, you are at least on social media, you have the account. So does that mean that, you know, when you become an internet sensation for using the big tools, or when something happens and you have to go over the wall?
Yeah. I mean, normally somebody will send me that stuff, you know, and I pull it up. I'm like, wow, that escalated quickly. But I was actually, the saw thing, we had that saw for like a year and never used it. And when we did use it, and somebody sent that to me, and they're like, ah, they put it on TV. I'm like, oh man, I'm like, this thing's long gone. And maybe I was not giving NASCAR credit enough. I'm pretty sure the officiating up top had already, because my official was like, they called down and told me you can't use that. And he was like, well, what? It's not in the rules. Because I already talked to him about it. I was like, hey, I'm getting ready to use this thing, and here's what the rule is. Because like, if a NASCAR official doesn't really know, they're going to err to the side of, you probably shouldn't do that, right? But like, we had knew exactly what the rule was and knew it was legal, and we had it for like a week or two, and then there was a new rule. So now we have just smaller saws.
Right. Yes. That was very, very funny of how that became such a story. I got a kick out of that. A few more things as we wrap up here. I just want to switch topics real quick, because again, the brief little interacting I had with Caitlin to get ready for this, she wanted me to bring up, and I was going to bring it up anyway, but being girl dad, because she said your daughter is kind of obsessed with you. And I've seen some of her posting of the videos of Cadence or videos you've been in. So how has that just been, being girl dad? Because Cadence seems like she's got quite the personality already. I think she's only 4, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. She just turned 4 and she does have quite the personality. She's a lot of fun. I mean, I don't know that I've ever thought of myself so much as a girl dad. I mean, maybe I'm sure I've probably softened up a little bit now that I have a little girl, but you know, as it is for everybody with kids, I'm sure it just changes your perspective on a lot of things. You know, all I've done is racing my whole life. And prior to being married and having kids and stuff, you know, I would be on the road and we'd go from track to that we raced at to test to another race, to another test to race. And you know, all these guys be like, man, I just want to go home. And I was single, no kids. I was like, I might as well just go to the next place. Who cares? I didn't really understand it. So I think just kids in general. And she loves being around me. She's a ton of fun. Anytime that I'm home, we try to, you know, take her and do whatever we can with the time that we do have off. And, you know, I think just the kids in general has been a big change, because, you know, you can go have a bad day at the racetrack and come home and it didn't affect her day. You know, she's just as happy to see you and wants to, you know, go have fun. And so that's definitely something that I enjoy.
Yeah. Real quick, I wanted to ask, because you brought up about the fact that you still have a business on the side, but I also understand, I think you and your family are still involved and do some Chili Bowl stuff every year, right?
Yeah. So my dad started, I can't really remember what year. It's been probably, I don't know, 5 or 6, 6 or 7 years now that he's been taking midgets to Tulsa for the Chili Bowl. And that kind of ties in with my shock company as well. When I lived in Colorado, our shock specialist on the 78 car, we started a suspension company. And basically I was racing in Colorado and I was starting a crew chief for guys and I would go test. And I just got tired of like having to deal with other people's stuff. So I was like, I'm just going to build my own shocks. We ended up buying a dyno. And now my partner, Nick, does it full time. We've got a couple East Coast guys. Nick does tons of rental stuff. I mean, we do like this year, we got our first World Outlaw win and All-Star win with a few guys. And we just pretty much from the top to bottom, dirt, asphalt, everything. And we kind of just do everything to kind of stay in business. And once Furniture Row shut down, Nick's wife's family is from Colorado. So it made sense for him to stay there and kind of do that business full time. So I still run a lot of the business side, do a lot of customer support in all my free time, as I'm sure Caitlin appreciates. But no, it's been a lot of fun. I mean, the last couple of years, we've really expanded. I think we did shocks for customers in over 40 states last year. Had, I think, somewhere between 100 and 150 wins with our customers. So that's been growing. That's been a lot of fun. And maybe when I'm done with the Cup Series full time, it'll be something that can, you know, that I can look forward to doing after the big league racing. But yeah, we try to go. I didn't make it last year because Dawson was born a couple weeks after the Chili Bowl. But like Nick goes to the Chili Bowl, has his dyno there. Like he serviced all my dad's stuff, all of our other customers. You know, we put the shocks on my dad's cars. We had Dave Darlin a couple of years ago for the guys that know dirt racing. And he's got a couple of really good midget drivers that have run for years for him. And that's a lot of fun. It's the week that I don't get to make the full week. I've never made the full week because that's our Daytona prep. I'm sure as you know, but I get to make 3 or 4 days of that. And that's kind of back to the roots, like going to race with my dad and our family deal. And my sister goes out, our whole family's there. So I definitely enjoy that. I hate that I missed that last year and definitely look forward to it this year.
Yeah. Let me squeeze in one last thing and end on this. We'll circle it back to the playoffs because of course we're in the midst of that important part of the season. Obviously drivers get asked all the time about what it's like to compete in the playoffs and the stress level and just going through the rounds. Let me get your perspective as a car chief, as someone who oversees a group of people, what is it like going through a playoff format, an elimination style playoff format?
Yeah, it's just about execution and not making mistakes. And we didn't start off the best this year with that. I mean, we had a really fast car at Darlington, sped late. Richmond, you know, had the start penalty early on and had to overcome that. And I feel like for whatever reason, our team is always having to come, you know, overcome adversity. Like it's always something, whether it's us screwing something up in tech and coming from the back or something in the race. So, I mean, but when you have that a lot, I think when you get into that scenario in a playoffs, you're accustomed to recovering. So execution and recovery and all the time that you spend, I just feel like everything is elevated a bit. You know, when you get to each next round, unless you're having a year like Larson's has as many bonus points as he's had, even late, you can still have things go wrong. But I mean, to put in perspective, I mean, we've won 4 races this year. So that's second to Larson. We've had, we have decent bonus points. We could go to Vegas and if we don't win, we could finish second or third in every stage in the race. And then if something happens and we have a early wreck or a motor failure or some mechanical issue at Talladega, I mean, you're on the bubble, if not out. So it's all of that. It's your entire season understanding that everything that you can control, you have to control well. In the preparation side, you just have to make sure that, you know, everything that you touch is to the best of your ability, knowing that, you know, you're not going to be hopefully the variable that costs your team something. So I think it's just like for the drivers. I mean, the first one, you're like, all right, as long as we don't screw up anything big, you know, we're probably going to get through to the next round. But you also know, like for us, Darlington and Richmond were really, really good tracks for Martin. So it's like, if we go execute and we kind of bring everything that we've got, like we can keep piling on some bonus points for later in those rounds. And that's what we've always tried to do. I mean, Vegas, really good place for Martin too. So this is the one for us that's really important to go run well at and maybe build a little cushion.
Right. Blake, I enjoyed this immensely. Thank you so much for doing it. And thanks again. I know it's been a long day, so I appreciate you doing it after you coming home.
No problem. Thanks for having me. It was good talking with you.
All right, there it is. We've got a car chief now on the podcast, and we are well educated into what goes into that role and being the right-hand man of a crew chief. Going through inspection, I thought that was quite cool for him to describe the relationship and how you want to be equals and be respectful of the NASCAR officials. So that was really cool insight. I appreciate that. And I just appreciate the conversation. I thought Blake was really good. I thought he was really interesting, and we had a great time. So again, I can't thank him enough for doing it after a long day at the shop. You heard what time he went in, and then we chatted at 7 p.m. that night when he had walked in the door at home. So I appreciate that very much. And again, thank you to Caitlin for planting the seed and giving me some background information to work with, as well as Tyler Overstreet of the 19 team and everybody at Joe Gibbs Racing that continues to be great to work with. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it a lot and learned about this new position. Again, I'm working really hard lately to think about different people and different players, different positions, different jobs, responsibilities in the sport that we can cover on the podcast that we haven't done before. It's easy to talk to drivers, right? We all want to talk to drivers. Everybody loves drivers. Crew chiefs. We've had crew chiefs, media members. We've had NHRA drivers. We've had a little bit of everybody, I think. But now we have a car chief, and I'm continuing to find other roles. So who knows? Maybe a hauler driver will pop up. We've had Kip Childress, the pace car driver. Maybe he's going to pop up again. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. Go on Patreon. You might find out if any of that is true. Patreon.com/Kelly Crandall. Of course, I got to plug that. Thank you for the continued support. If you've listened to the past couple episodes, you've heard me say how you guys have been tremendous in not only helping me pay my bills, but get to the racetrack. And after this weekend at Charlotte, which was in my backyard, next up will be Martinsville, and then hopping on a plane to go out to Phoenix to cover the championship race, and that's all through your support. So thank you for that. But in all seriousness, if you go to Patreon, you will learn who the upcoming guests are. You will know when I'm recording those interviews if you would like to offer questions to those guests. So go over there, check it out. That link is also in the show description of this episode. And of course, the natural thing to do, the old school thing to do, is just leave a rating and review and let me know what you think. Hit the subscribe button if you haven't done that already. You can find me on social media at Kelly Crandall, straight across the board. Instagram, Twitter, the public Facebook page. I always stress to make sure you're checking for that, not the private one. You're not going to find me on there. Hardly ever use it. So Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, you can find me. Leave a message. Tell me what you think. Go back to the archives. Again, we're having a lot of great conversations on the podcast, and I can't thank you all enough for clicking and listening every week. All right, with that, I am done for this week. That is another episode in the books. We are getting closer to that 200 mark. I had someone ask me if I was going to do anything special for that episode, and I have nothing special planned, as I told you guys a couple weeks ago, but if you have any suggestions of how we can celebrate that accomplishment, because it is a pretty cool number. I know in NASCAR, we like the number 200, don't we? So if anybody has any suggestions, I'm open to them of how we can celebrate the cool accomplishment. Again, we're going to hit that milestone here soon. So reach out to me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Let me know. Reach out to me on Patreon, and maybe we'll have some fun and we'll do something cool for that. Next week, Sam Hunt, team owner in the Xfinity Series. Sam was another really great conversationalist. We dig into Sam Hunt Racing, a little bit of his background, how he got here, living in a van, the drivers now that he's putting in his car, and what the future looks like for that organization. He has a great, great partnership with Toyota and Joe Gibbs Racing and is doing great things with that 26 car. And we're going to learn all about it next week. So that's coming to you right here next Monday on the Racing Writers Podcast.